Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, debunking the mythology of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Most historians understand the bombings were totally unnecessary, and they were bombed mostly on civilians. But the war was really over, and the Japanese were trying to get out, and the American intelligence knew that because we'd broken the codes. So it's not a very pleasant story when you get deeper into what we now know.
Out of the mushroom clouds, nuclearism's dark expanding circle.
The blast went off, and we were to walk up to the ground zero. But the wind changed direction. The buses that we were taking back to the huts and that were all contaminated. I imagine some of the people were contaminated before they got in the bus.
And the world's latest brand new weapon, killer robots.
Weapon systems that once they've been activated or put in place, they use sensors to collect data. They then calculate whether the information sensed matches a kind of target profile of what they're supposed to be hitting. And if that matches up, then they will apply force automatically without a human making a specific decision about where and when and what exactly is hit by this weapon system.
Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Seventy-eight years ago, on August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped a uranium-enriched fission bomb, Little Boy, on the Japanese port city Hiroshima. 3 days later, they dropped a plutonium-triggered implosion device, Fat Man, on Nagasaki. When the dust settled, almost a quarter million lay dead or dying, most of them civilians. Thousands more would sicken and die in the years to come. America's official rationale, avoiding huge casualties from a ground invasion of Japan. The real reasons would emerge in time. Gar Alperovitz has written a pair of books about the nuclear bombing of Japan. Alperovitz is a historian, political economist, activist, and writer, and the co-founder of something called the Next System Project. I reached Gar Alperovitz in Washington, D.C. Have you seen Oppenheimer?
Yes, I have.
Tell me what you think.
Well, I've also had correspondence with him because I've written two books on the bombing of Hiroshima and the atomic diplomacy of that period. And I thought the film was quite good. Two good friends of mine were the authors of the book it was based on, Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin. And I thought what it did not get us into was the necessity or non-necessity of bombing Hiroshima, which we now know was probably not at all necessary. The Japanese are desperately trying to surrender, and that's a long story, but I've written two books on the subject, so it's well known by now. We'd broken the Japanese codes, so the White House knew what was going on because they were reading the secret codes with the Japanese going back and forth with the Russians, trying to find a way out of the war without more killing.
So 78 years later, what do we now know about the real reasons for dropping Little Boy and Fat Man on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, we don't have absolute documentation of everything because there were no notes on the private conversations between the president and the key decision maker, a man named the Secretary of State, James Burns. Truman was a novice at this point. He'd been in office only a couple months. And Burns was an old hand who had brought Harry Truman up as a senator when he was in the Senate, and knew his way around Washington and knew his way around the government. And at this point in time, Truman later fired him, really was the dominant figure in the story. And what we now know is that, one, they had broken the Japanese codes. Two, they knew they were desperately trying to get out of the war. Three, U.S. intelligence had said, when the Russians come into the war, we had asked them to come in to help us. And they said they'd come in 3 months after Germany surrendered, time enough to get their troops across the Trans-Siberian Railway. Germany surrendered on May 8th, 1945. They were about to come in on August 8th, as promised. Note the timing. The bomb, Hiroshima, was bombed on August 6th, and Nagasaki was bombed on August 9th. And at this point in time, I think it's most historians understand the bombings were totally unnecessary. And they were bombed mostly on civilians. Hiroshima was not a military target. There were a very tiny office there, but it was not a military target. There was more base, more reason to consider Nagasaki partly a military target. But the war was really over, and the Japanese were trying to get out. And the American intelligence knew that because we'd broken the codes. So it's not a very pleasant story one way or another when you get deeper into what we now know.
And so Burns knew all this but did not tell Truman?
No. Truman was fully aware of what was going on.
Truman knew that the military had cracked the Japanese code and that they were wanted to surrender. He knew all this?
He knew that the Japanese were trying to find a way to surrender. He knew the code was cracked. He had all of the intelligence at the time. And there wasn't much fighting going on because the U.S. was preparing for a theoretically possible invasion, which couldn't take place until November, 3 months later.
But now a whole host of senior five-star U.S. generals were apparently telling Truman and telling the leaders, there's no point in dropping the bomb. The Japanese have lost the war. We should not drop the bomb.
Well, that's a little strong. We have on record the intelligence telling Truman that the war was likely to end long before an invasion, because it couldn't start till November, and we're talking about Hiroshima is August 6th, Nagasaki is August 9th. So we know he was told the war would end before the invasion, in their judgment, because they'd broken the code, and the Japanese were desperately trying to get the Russians to come in and help them negotiate a surrender. There was plenty of time to test whether the intelligence was true, but instead they bombed essentially a civilian target.
So who were the generals, who were the five-star generals in the U.S. military who were telling Truman and his administration, don't drop the bomb? Who were the generals? I know Eisenhower was one of them.
Eisenhower has a private conversation with him, with Truman at Potsdam, which he doesn't exactly say don't drop the bomb, but he makes it clear that he doesn't think it's necessary. We do know that Truman was advised the war would end by high intelligence without an invasion. Admiral Leahy, who was Truman's chief of staff and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but about a six-star admiral, as high as you can get, later wrote, I wasn't taught to make war on women and children. It was outrageous to many military figures. Eisenhower said pretty much the same thing in a softer language.
So who are the ones who were saying, we got to drop the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we got to drop them, in spite of the intelligence?
Well, the planning for this was really being done by the president. Truman was in office 3 months. Roosevelt died on May 8th, 1945. Truman had no real inside knowledge of what was going on. He was he was not a practitioner of diplomacy. He was a novice. Jimmy Burns, who he made Secretary of State, is the dominant figure at this point in time. Truman is quoted as saying, if the bomb works as predicted, I'll have a hammer on those boys, meaning the Russians. Diplomatic historians know what was going on. Truman was scheduled to meet with the Russians at Potsdam, Germany, for the first post-war conference. The bomb test had just happened in July 16th. Potsdam takes place between the test, July 16th. Truman sits down with Stalin the next morning. The conference goes on settling or attempting to settle European issues at post-war period. The bomb is tested on July 16th. Truman meets with Stalin July 17th. By design, we wanted to know if the bomb worked. He said, it'll give me a hammer on those boys, meaning the Russians, not the Japanese. Everyone knew the Japanese war was just about over. So it's not a very pretty story. And then they rushed the bomb forward on August 6th on Hiroshima and August 9th on Nagasaki.
But I get, again, the question, Gar Alperovitz, is the generals were saying it's not clear. We don't have evidence saying they actually told, there's nothing in writing that they told Truman, don't drop it. But they all were of the view, and they recall conveying the view to the administration. Who are the ones who were saying, in spite of the intelligence, we got to drop the bomb, we got to drop the bomb. The Russians, we've agreed with the Russians are going to go invade Manchuria and then move on to Japan. We don't need to drop the bomb. Who was telling Truman, drop the bomb, drop the bomb? The generals weren't. Was Burns saying, drop the bomb, in spite of the known intelligence?
Yes, Truman and Burns, and Truman also saw it that way at this point from his diaries. This will give me a hammer on those boys, meaning the Russians he was meeting with at Potsdam.
Even though he knew that the Japanese were about wanted to surrender.
Even though he knew that all the intelligence suggested that Japan was going to surrender long before a landing, the first landing in November, could take place, and all the ships had moved in and everything was ready. So it was certainly possible to see if all the intelligence, which said Japan was trying to surrender, the Russians would come in at our request. The war would end according to U.S. intelligence.
But this was a terribly cynical picture you're painting, which I'm sure is largely known today, that Harry Truman went ahead and ordered the bombs to be dropped, saying that publicly thereafter that this would obviate the need to attack the Japanese mainland because the Japanese won't surrender and it's going to cost us like a million lives. Truman went ahead and ordered the bombing, knowing that this was all not true.
Well, that's not true is a little bit stronger than I would use, but not very much stronger, because the intelligence suggested strongly to the president before the bombs were used, U.S. intelligence, that it was unnecessary, that the war would end as soon as the Russians came in at our request.
Okay, so you've mentioned a couple of times that one of the principal reasons for going ahead and dropping the bomb, even though it wasn't militarily necessary, was to get the hammer on the Russians to seek a position of establish a position of dominance vis-a-vis the Russians in the post-war period. Did they also drop the bombs because they wanted to test them? They wanted to, I mean, having developed these bombs, what the heck? You can imagine that Oppenheimer and Groves, for sure, they really wanted to test them out.
Well, the bombs had been tested at Alamogordo.
Yeah, but not on a civilian population.
No, that's right. That's right. So you can say that it was a laboratory experiment costing 200,000 lives, but it would be, that's a pretty nasty thing to look at.
I mean, is there any evidence to suggest that people said this? In the documentary record, that people were saying, what the heck? Oh dear, the war's going to end. The war's going to end. The Japanese are about to surrender. The Russians are about to invade them. It's all about to end, and we will not have had the chance to test our bombs.
I did not find anything like that in the record. The dates are interesting. Truman kept putting off his meeting with the Russians at Potsdam, Germany, because they kept pushing off the test of the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb was tested in New Mexico on July 16th. Truman sat down with Stalin the next morning.
But it was a small bomb. It wasn't a little boy, it was a bigger bomb. And Fat Man was a plutonium implosion bomb. So it was a totally different design. You'd imagine they would have wanted to test them.
Well, they were confident once the test in New Mexico took place that the bomb would work. That was not in question, at least I didn't find any evidence that they thought the bomb used in Japan wouldn't work.
Why did they drop the second bomb on Nagasaki, having dropped the first one on Hiroshima? Why did they drop the second one on Nagasaki? What was the purpose of that?
Well, again, we don't have inside information on what they really thought. What we know is that Truman was advised that the war would end when the Russians came in on August 8th. We had been begging them to come in before the bomb was tested, before the bomb was a reality. As soon as the bomb was a reality, then we tried to stall it a little bit with not much success, they came in a couple of days later anyway, as planned. That was the agreement. Note the dates. Hiroshima was bombed August 6th, and Nagasaki was bombed on August 9th. They didn't want the Russians involved in the war once they had the bomb. They desperately rushed to get the bombing in, and they sacrificed these two essentially civilian targets at that point in time.
Did they drop the Nagasaki bomb because it was a plutonium implosion bomb and it was going to release neutrons and Nagasaki was sitting in a bowl surrounded by hills, whereas Hiroshima was sitting in a on a flat surface, and they realized that the bomb would create neutrons reflecting off the walls around Nagasaki, the hills, and they wanted to test that?
Yes, that's right.
Is this account, this narrative, true?
It is true. That is what you said is accurate. They wanted to test both bombs, the different type, slightly different type design. That's absolutely true. Unnecessarily, in my view, and in the view of many, many historians, including the top military, Eisenhower said it wasn't necessary to use that. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff publicly said it wasn't necessary to use the bomb. Many top military leaders said this was basically outrageous. These are civilian targets and unnecessary at this point in time.
Is this publicly known today in the United States? Like, how widespread is this knowledge in the United States?
Well, it's been published in many, many books, including my own, that we now have this information. It didn't come out right away, but within a year or two, it began to seep out that the military thought this was outrageous.
And the bombs would become, of course, nuclearism would become the central pillar of post-war international diplomacy in the international political scene, and this seems to be best exemplified or typified for me by the existence of the five permanent powers of the UN system. The five permanent powers in the UN Security Council are the five powers with nuclear weapons. So nuclear weapons became kind of like the entrance card to being amongst the five most powerful countries in the world. And I think about Bikini, like, you know, the testing of the nuclear weapons in Bikini and Uitak, that amongst the most interesting facets of this is that each of the services wanted their own bomb, right? Yeah. So you know, the Air Force, of course, had its bombs. They had dropped those bombs from, you know, Little Boy and Fat Man. They dropped them from airplanes. So the Air Force had their bombs. The Army wanted their bombs to shoot missiles out of guns, big guns, and the Navy wanted their bombs to set off at the surface of the water and below the water. And so this was all competition for funding and prestige within the U.S. military status, and they all got their bombs. The arsenal proliferated and the corporations proliferated.
Yeah, well, put it another way, there was no powerful source within the U.S. government, which was seriously committed to and had the political power inside the government to press for a different strategy. There was another strategy which Churchill was pushing at one point in the early Cold War when he saw this buildup of nuclear weapons on both sides is insane. Because, yes, we may be able to destroy the Russians, but they've got submarines that will shoot back. This is crazy. There was no source with enough power in the U.S. government to put forward a real strategy to stop this arms race. And indeed, that was so it went on in a kind of a haphazard way for a long time. And both sides kept saying, we've got to get more bombs because the other side's got more bombs, and what happens, we better get a submarine capacity because they may get the airplanes. So it went on and on, and now it's sort of a stalemate. It's, you know, they say two scorpions in a bottle. If one side shoots, the other side's going to shoot back because you can't get all of the bombs of the Russians or the Chinese, and the Chinese can't get all of our bombs. So it's a standoff right now, but it's a very dangerous standoff.
Let me ask you a counterfactual question, or question arising from, you know, counterfactual history. What would have happened, do you think, what might have happened if the U.S. had decided not to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if they had followed through on their agreement with the Russians, let the Russians invade Japan? It would have all ended. The bombs would never have been tested. Japan would have surrendered, it would have been over. What do you think would have unfolded over the course of the following decades, you know, through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s? This is completely hypothetical. Do you ever reflect on this?
As a nuclear historian, we all debated that, or reflected on it is the right word. Had there been leadership to really move forward on nuclear disarmament, which would have required enormous inspection in Russia and in the United States, had we been really serious about the dangers involved, and had we really made an effort to do that and stopped our own testing, possibly you could have avoided the buildup of nuclear weapons. It's a long shot because human nature being what it is, the Russians saw we had bombs. They probably wanted their own. We weren't going to get rid of ours. And probably it's a very dicey story. But what we did instead, we both sides went ahead and built as fast as they could. And it's been a nuclear standoff since then. Fortunately, they haven't been used so far.
Gar Alperovitz is a political economist, activist, and writer. He's the author of two books about the nuclear bombing of Japan. Atomic Diplomacy, Hiroshima and Potsdam was published in 1965. His 1995 work, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb and the Architecture of an American Myth, updated the story. Alperovitz co-founded the Democracy Collaborative, a center for research on ecologically sustainable community-based economics. For more details, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were just the start. Building bombs would become a booming business for America and the other four franchised weapon states, Russia, China, the UK, and France. A half dozen other upstarts carved out their own smaller arsenals. It became big business, digging uranium out of the ground, enriching it, building bombs to shoot and drop from airplanes, rocket launchers, or submarines, testing nukes in the atmosphere or below ground. Power plants put the peaceful atom to work. Nuclear waste got dumped in the seas, buried underground, processed into fertilizer, or packed into the warheads of non-nuclear missiles to harden them. Countless workers labored or wandered in the fields of the bomb. Countless died. This is something I produced back in 1986. In order of appearance, you'll hear Rosalie Bertel, late Canadian-American anti-nuclear activist and authority on the health effects of radionuclides, Al Draper, one of many servicemen recruited to observe nuclear bomb tests in the Nevada desert. Ward Churchill was a professor at the University of Colorado at the time of this recording. Donna Smith was an English professor at Acadia University in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, and an anti-uranium activist. No immediate danger, this is called.
If you are into the mentality that you're saving a 10-megaton blast on Toronto or New York or Montreal or Paris or wherever, you can trade a few lives in a uranium mining community or downwind of a test site or spread out in time and space, that seems pretty small to preventing this major holocaust. However, it's taking us down the road of preparation for megadeath. This came home to me one time. I had gone to the U.S. State Department for an official briefing. This was a briefing on SALT II, and they had spent the whole day talking about what we've got and what they've got, and payload and backfire bombers and MIRV and MARV and, you know, the whole thing. It was just an ugly day, one thing after the other of death. And at the end of the afternoon, when they finally got to a question period, I asked the question, how many people die every year for this program, if you count everything from uranium mining and milling and transportation and reactors and fabricating the weapons and testing the weapons and the waste disposal, how many people do you figure die every year to produce these bombs? And there was a great deal of embarrassment, I would say, on the stage. They looked to one another, who is going to answer this? And it was Paul Warnke who finally came to the microphone, and his answer was, that's not our department.
The ocean. There was a small town on the headland, turned towards sideland the ocean.
The tritium level in Lake Ontario was unmeasurable by the ordinary instruments prior to March 1st, 1954. On March 1st, 1954, the hydrogen bomb explosion in Bikini released a tremendous amount of tritium, and the level in Lake Ontario, which is some 8,000 miles away, rose to about 500 tritium units per liter of water. You know, it was amazing how few North Americans even know that there are, have been 600 tests in Nevada. Some of the underground tests are deliberately designed to leak radiation to the air. It was measured in 1986 from the Mighty Oaks underground test in Nevada. It was measured by the Canadian Inland Waterways Center in Hamilton. A central conservative estimate of the number of radiation victims, not even counting Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is about 16 million. Now, it's absolutely mind-boggling that this many people can be damaged and we can be so unaware of it, except that they primarily are the people who do not have political voice. They're indigenous people, they're islanders, they're people in countries with no voice like Namibia, they're the Aboriginal people of Australia, the native people of North America.
We were about 4 miles, between 3.5 and 4 miles. And it was early in the morning. The blast went off, and we were to walk up to ground zero, but the wind changed direction, and we were called back. The buses that we were taking back to the huts and that were all contaminated. I imagine some of the people were contaminated before they got in the bus. And
I would point to a study done by Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory in New Mexico, which was the primary nuclear research facility in the United States, which recommended in 1978 that, and I quote, perhaps a solution to the radon problem is to forbid human habitation of mining and milling areas. Now, I would point out that the mining and milling areas, the only ones in question in the United States, happen to be the territories of the two most populous land-based peoples, American Indian peoples remaining, that being the Navajo and the Lakota. Federal government has created a term called National Sacrifice Area to accommodate locations which are this heavily contaminated. In the case of Laguna, I think we might begin to talk about, from the U.S. perspective, a National Sacrifice people.
I think of a young guy who, at one of our local stores, and a woman who runs the store was telling me that this is a guy who is kind of hanging around, didn't have a job, he's just got a high school and everything, and she was saying, hey, did you hear that they found uranium over there? And he says, uranium? You mean we got uranium? Wow, it's better than gold! And I think it's associated in people's minds instantly with who's got power and who hasn't.
Another place we're investigating right now is the end of the line for a good bit.